So I'm not so sure about the why yet, but I can try. And so in some sense, this is a follow-up to William's talk from last Tuesday, but I'm not going to assume that you remember what that was about. So, and also, I should probably say that coinologic is not something that I otherwise work on. I'm far from an expert in this, and so if there's anything that I'm saying wrong or that I should have said about quantum logic, then please feel free to interrupt. So I want to start by saying a little bit about what quantum logic actually is, and then I'll get to what this undecidability means, and then I'll say something about the proof and other things that it's kind of related to. Okay, so first of all, what is quantum logic? So quantum logic, I think, started with Birkhoff and von Neumann. The idea being that all these weird things that happen in quantum theory are somehow an illusion due to us reasoning about it in the wrong way, that we're using our kind of everyday classical logic. But so it might be that it's just the wrong kind of rules of logic to use for quantum systems. And so they've tried to come up with different rules for logic, weaker rules for logic, which would somehow naturally eliminate potentially these strange things. And so, for example, in Boolean logic, we're all used to using the fact that logical AND distributes over logical OR. So if we say that P AND Q OR R, then this statement is equivalent to P AND Q OR P AND R, meaning that if one side holds, then so does the other one. This you can just check, right, by assigning all possible values of true and false to these variables, and you'll see that it holds in all cases. So this is one of the rules that we're kind of used to, and that we might even use without noticing it, because it seems so kind of basic and obvious. But this rule actually fails in quantum logic. So technically, what does quantum logic mean? So these, instead of interpreting these variables as true values, so meaning as true or false, they then get interpreted as projection operators on a Hilbert space, or in your space of states, or equivalently as closed subspaces. So if you have a projection operator, that means that it's an observable with values 0 or 1. And so 0 being interpreted as false and 1 being interpreted as true. and so then if you look at the eigenspace associated to the outcome 1, that will be a closed subspace, which also determines its complement, which is the eigenspace at eigenvalue 0. So this is how the projection operator determines the closed subspace, and conversely, you can, when you have the closed subspace, just project onto it, and that gives the projection operator. So these two descriptions are equivalent, and sometimes I might be confusing the two a little bit, so I'm kind of using this. Okay, so what connectors do we have? So here I was talking about and OR. So how do we combine these quantum propositions? So this is again, I want to use and, or, and negation. These are kind of supposed to be the basic connectives of logic, so we should better have some way to treat these at that level. So the and corresponds to intersection of the subspaces. So just, I think that should be kind of intuitive if you look at all the states on which one thing is true, you look at all the states on which another thing is true, then the set of states in which both are true should just be the intersection of the two. So that's roughly the idea. the logical OR is a little bit more complicated. So it corresponds to taking a closed linear span in this kind of conventional formulation. So yeah, you just take the two subspaces and then the linear subspace generated by the two. And sometimes you have to also close it again topologically in infinite dimensions. Okay, and finally negation. So this should maybe be the most intuitive one. It's just taking the orthogonal complement. So these are kind of the definitions that Birkhoff and von Neumann wrote down. And now one can look, well, what properties does the resulting calculus of quantum logic have? So for example, as I was saying earlier, this distributivity does not hold. Can anyone maybe propose or know, does anyone know an example? Or I kind of would like to illustrate it. And do you find this clear? Is it hard? Okay, so I'll try to draw an example. So this actually already happens in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, so state space of a qubit. So I'll just draw kind of two arbitrary axes to illustrate a two-dimensionality. And so I need to choose three p, q, and r, which were supposed to be subspaces, such that that equation is violated. In order to get a violation, I should better try and have these to be non-trivial, meaning neither of these should be just consist just of the origin or be the entire space. So I should choose them one-dimensional. And so also then I should better choose them different just to make it as kind of as generic as possible. So then I can choose, oops, this is not a very good subspace, but okay, this goes through the origin, right? I choose P, some Q, and then R. Okay. Well, so now if I take Q or R, that means I need to consider the subspace spanned by these two subspaces, and I get the entire thing. So then if I take P and that, well, I still get P. But on the right-hand side, I need to first do the two ands. The P and Q consists only of the origin, and likewise Q and R as well. So on the right-hand side, I just get the origin. So this illustrates how this failure comes about, and I think this is kind of the generic way in which that distributivity fails. Okay, so now the question is which laws of logic are still valid quantumly with these connectives? And so in particular, some of the rules of classical logic actually still apply, so that P or not P is always true. So kind of the law of excluded middle is still valid. That we have a law of non-contradiction saying that P and not P cannot both be true at the same time. And we have a concept called orthomodularity. So if P is less than or equal to Q, so this you can actually think of implication. So if P implies Q, then P or not P and Q still the same as Q. So this is, in some sense, a relaxed form of the distributivity. And it's quite strongly relaxed. But I think this follows from the distributivity and the non-contradiction. So if you take R to be P perp, and you apply the law of non-contradiction and the commutativity of the OR or something, then this should follow.
Should I think of less than or equal to as also connective of some kind, or what's the?
You can implement it as a connective, but you don't have to. So in this case, I don't mean it as a connective, but you can, I think you can implement it as a connective and then kind of make it part of this equation. Okay. So then as a connective, I mean, it would be Q or P perp. But there are also other quantum implications that are of a different form that people have proposed. But I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I don't really know much about this. Okay, but so the question that I'm concerned with and that I would like to answer, which has been an open question for a long time in quantum logic, is whether there's kind of a way to classify all of these laws that still are valid in all these Hilbert spaces. And so this is maybe a bit of a vague question. I mean, what do you mean by classify? And so the question that I would like to answer, the precise question that I would like to pose and then answer, is that what is the complexity, the sense of computational complexity, of telling whether a given candidate law is actually valid or not? And so this would then give an answer to the possibility of classifying them. So if the complexity is simple, then you can say, well, then that algorithm which answers this decision problem, that sort of provides the classification. And if the complexity is hard, then we can say, well, no, it's not possible to classify all of them. And in that sense, that maybe an argument against quantum logic, maybe that the entire endeavor is not so interesting because of this complexity. And this is precisely what I'm going to show.
In the classical case, what's the answer to the complexity question?
NP hard, but decidable. I mean, so there's an obvious algorithm to answer it by you just try out all the possible truth values for all the observables. But it's still not easy. So in a sense, so it's still an NP complete problem. It's called a satisfiability problem, or just SAT. Okay, and so the theorem is that there is no algorithm to decide whether a certain kind of law in quantum logic is valid. And what I mean by law in this case, and I'm going to make that even more concrete later on, is a law of a potential or a candidate law of this form, that I assume a bunch of things and I ask whether that implies something else. And these are sort of and this implies are kind of external. Just like here, I made this kind of assumption on the P and Q, how they relate. And I concluded that if this holds, then they must satisfy this. So this is one law that is valid. And here I'm considering all the potential laws that are of this form. More generally, one could ask, well, does it imply something else? So does it imply some F1 or some F2? I mean, this is still a very specific kind of law.
Are the ands external or are they?
They are external. So what I'm writing in actual English, these are the external connectives. And the ones that I'm using writing in symbols, these are the internal ones. Okay, and so more specifically, it is even impossible to decide this, or to have an algorithm that decides it, when the EI and the F are of one of the following two forms, that it can be an equation like before, but now phrased only in terms of the variables, the OR, and zero, which represents false, or it could be an orthogonality relation between two variables. So an orthogonality relation would be, I suppose I have one, or I impose that P is orthogonal to Q. This is a bit like I had on a previous slide, the P less than or equal Q. I guess I could write this equivalently as, what would that be? Something like P perp or Q perp is true, I suppose. Right. Something like that. I mean, you can rewrite this in terms of an equation. But just for the proof and how to think about it, I'm going to call these orthogonality relations because this is what they're going to be. OK, so these are the kinds of laws that I want to work with. A bunch of assumptions in terms of these equations or orthogonality relations. And here, a sequent that is of the same form. So to give a concrete example, suppose that we assume that P or Q is true, Q or R is true, and R or P is true. And moreover, these three projection operators are also pairwise orthogonal. Then, well, it's not so hard to see that in this case, they must actually, all of them must be zero. And also one must be zero, so this is kind of a contradiction. So from these assumptions, one can derive a contradiction, which means that these assumptions are kind of mutually contradictory. Yeah. Does that kind of make sense, roughly?
Quite clear that it sounded like you said that that's not a valid implication because it's a contradiction.
No, it is a valid implication. It's just that what one concludes, so the implicant is false, basically. If you have something from which you conclude false, that's what contradiction means. No?
But what is it in the antecedent that ensures? Sorry. No, I still don't get it. So.
So I make these three assumptions. And the pairwise orthogonalities. Mm-hmm. And these assumptions are contradictory in the sense that the only way to realize them is on a zero-dimensional Hilbert space. So from this, I can conclude.
So the idea is that identity.
Yeah.
I thought this identity was not identity on the zero-dimensional Hilbert space. It was identity on the Hilbert space in which things were embedded. But So if it's identity on, say, a two-dimensional Hilbert space, then it's just a contradiction. If I set P and Q and R to zero-dimensional, then I can't satisfy this person's relation.
Right. Yeah. So in this case, the law would be vacuous in a sense; it wouldn't tell you anything.
So that this would imply a contradiction, and anything follows from a contradiction. So that's the only sense in which that's true.
Let me try to write it down in a. So this implies that P is zero. By the same logic, I can conclude that Q is zero, that R is zero, and by this assumption, I can conclude that 1 is zero.
Right.
So this is a valid implication. And so this implication is valid irrespectively of the Hilbert space dimension.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of what law of quantum logic means. It should apply, it should be valid whenever, no matter what Hilbert space you have. And the way that you can interpret it, but this is just a matter of interpretation independently of the validity, is that in any Hilbert, that these assumptions enforce that the entire space must be equal to the origin. So the Hilbert space is zero-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So this means the only way to realize these things is on a zero-dimensional Hilbert space.
Okay.
So what is the status of this implication? Does this hold for all Hilbert spaces or not?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Trivially, I guess. Is
hmm?
So, okay, that's what you've just...
Yes, so you can think of it as saying, or one way to think about it is that in dimension at least one, these assumptions are not even implementable. So hence the implication is sort of trivially valid. And in zero dimensions, the implicant is true, so it's also valid.
So this is an example. Are you going to use this example to prove your theorem?
Oh, no. This is just
an example.
In some sense, a silly example because I haven't been able to come up with anything less trivial. So what I'm going to use to prove the theorem is actually Williams results from kind of group theory. Yeah, there are going to be some more examples later that may be a little bit more sensible than this one, which is kind of very degenerate.
I have maybe just, it's not strictly necessary, but I've, what is a proposition in this case? Like, can you give an example? Is it like, would a proposition be the quantum state is a position eigenstate? Is that a proposition? Just to get some kind of more concrete idea what these P's and Q's are.
Yes, that could be, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But yes. In a concrete application, this would be...
Uh-oh. Is that the null state?
No, we've arrived here.
I mean, what I'm getting at is propositions are statements about the properties of the system.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Something like
in a particular state.
Okay.
So yeah, this is how I understand that this stuff is supposed to be applied.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could then use these laws to reason about these things in a particular situation. Okay, so the undecidability result that I'm going to present is even more specific. So with this kind of problem, when you show that a certain decision problem has high complexity, it's better. You get a stronger statement if you make the class of questions that a decision problem consists of as specific as possible, right? The more specific, the stronger the result. So this is already quite specific in a sense. But what I'm going to say is that I'm going to even make it more specific than that. namely, that needs a little bit of preparation. And so I just want to recall a fact about projections, or equivalently about closed subspaces, if you want. So if you have n projections on the same Hilbert space, then the following two are equivalent. The first says that their sum is the identity operator. And the second condition is that when you take this logical OR, quantum logical OR, you get true, and that they are pairwise orthogonal. So I guess a lot of you know this, but also classically, you can just, in terms of classical logic, this would be saying that among a bunch of propositions, exactly one is true. This is how to think of the sum. And then this is equivalent to saying that at least one of them is true, and they are pairwise exclusive. No two of them can happen at the same time. Okay, then this equivalence is clear, and this is kind of a quantum generalization of that equivalence. And this is sort of the main lemma that I'm going to apply in order to translate from, let's say, just algebra, namely statements about sums of projection operators, into this quantum logic. And this is how these kinds of expressions come about. Equations phrased only in terms of these variables, the OR and zero. Maybe this should have been a one, actually, but it doesn't. I mean, yeah. Doesn't maybe matter very much, and these orthogonality relations. Okay, so the point is that one can express this algebraic statement in terms of the quantum logic. Okay, and just to have a shorthand notation for this, I'm going to denote it by O C of these P's. O standing for orthogonality and C standing for completeness. Like in a basis, right? If you have an orthonormal basis, it should be orthogonal and complete. And this is just the same thing, except that a piece don't have to be rank one projectors, so they don't need to project onto individual vectors, but just onto subspaces. So yeah, this is a generic kind of thing that you get when you have some observable and you take the spectral decomposition. Then you get a bunch of projection operators like this.
I'm having trouble seeing your slides. I'm wondering if anyone else would mind if I turn off some of the front lights.
Oh yeah, great, yeah, yeah. Yeah, thanks. Okay, yeah, good.
Sorry, what does OC stand for?
Just for either of these conditions.
Okay. What did letters OC stand for?
Yeah, O stands for orthogonality and C for completeness. Like in a basis, just that here I don't have rank one projections, but
okay.
the eigenspace projections of an observable are like this, right? Okay. Yeah. And now just to have a convenient language for phrasing the particular laws of quantum logic that I want to be concerned with, I need to introduce this definition. So by a hypergraph, I just mean a finite set V, which stands for vertices. I'm going to have a kind of an illustration on the next slide, and a collection of subsets that are called hyperedges. And so if I have a family of projections indexed by these vertices, then I can talk about sort of it satisfying the orthogonality and completeness relations associated to these hyperedges. Okay, so just to every edge, for every edge, I want to say this OC of the collection of vertices that live on, sorry, projections that live on the vertices that the edge contains. And I want to sort of impose that these should be pairwise orthogonal and complete. Well, they should satisfy this sort of thing. They should kind of be like a basis, form an orthonormal basis. Except that the projections don't have to be rank one necessarily. Okay, and so the decision problem that I will show to be undecidable is given a hypergraph. No, sorry, that I will not show to be undecidable. But now one can ask: given a hypergraph, is there a quantum representation? So by this, I mean a bunch of projections associated to the vertices in such a way that for each one of the hyper edges, one has the spaces type property of orthogonality and completeness. So let's, and just to give an example, we could look at this. and so I now want to ask, is it possible to associate it to each of these vertex a projection operator on some Hilbert space, I mean all of them on the same Hilbert space, in such a way that for each of these regions or hyper edges, we have this orthogonality and completeness. Is that clear? So in this case, the answer is positive, and that's because this. For those of you who like Bell's theorem and that sort of stuff, because this is kind of a representation of what's called a CHSH scenario in this language. But yeah, more about this sort of stuff is in here.
So just a quick question.
Yeah?
So the projector associated to one hyper edge, which has, say, four vertices in it, is the tensor product of the projectors of each vertex.
So I'm not associating projections to hyper edges.
Oh, then I'm lost.
I'm associating projections to the vertices.
Okay.
Right, but
and so to every hyper edge, you can say, well, your associative projection is given by the sum of the projections on the vertices that it contains, but I'm requiring that to be one. So there's nothing like a tensor product or composite systems or anything here. I mean, within quantum logic,
a hyper edge just defines the set of projectors which you're comparing for orthogonal.
Yes, this defines the set of quantum representations of the hypergraph.
Okay, the thing that was confusing me is just the color coding, because then
what's
the significance then of the colors.
Mm. Yeah, right. Okay, so in this context, it doesn't really have any significance at all. But they are somehow related to a kind of operational interpretation of these edges in terms of the Bell's theorem stuff, but I think I don't want to get into this here at the moment. My purposes now, they all have the same meaning, namely this kind of normalization of these projections of orthogonality and completeness. Okay. So this may have been not so difficult, but now what if you remove some of these vertices? Is it still possible then? And so now you can imagine that it's maybe not so easy to answer this question. You can try to do it numerically. Just do some kind of numerical optimization or look for a solution to a system of equations. But that only works in a fixed Hilbert space dimension, right? But here I'm asking, does there exist some Hilbert space dimension which has a quantum representation? So there's also kind of allowing the Hilbert space to be chosen freely, which is arguably, in some sense, a physical case. and in this case, you can't just do it numerically, because you don't know the dimension in advance. And there are examples where you need to go larger and larger. Okay, so this actually is so difficult, answering this kind of decision problem, that no algorithm is known. But also proving that there is no algorithm, so proving undecidability also seems to be difficult. So this is kind of a question that we've posed in this paper. And it seems reasonable to suspect that it's undecidable, but it's a difficult problem. But what I can prove to be undecidable is a very similar kind of decision problem. It's a slightly more complicated than this one, which is why I wanted to introduce this one first. Namely, it says, given a hypergraph and some vertex that is somehow distinguished, does there exist not just any old quantum representation of the hypergraph, but does that vertex necessarily zero in every quantum representation? Or if you negate this, you would get the decision problem, is there a quantum representation of the hypergraph where this projector PW is non-zero? So one of these two things is going to happen, and the decision problem consists of finding out which of the two actually happens. And so another example would be kind of from the previous slide, just remove some of these vertices. And I want to consider this one, let's say as a distinguished W. So in this case, the answer turns out to be positive. It is true that in every quantum representation of this guy, which it still has quantum representations, but in every such one, this must be the zero projection. And this is also, not quite trivial, but it has a lot to do with Hardy's paradox. it's kind of a quantum version of that. Okay. So now the main theorem is that this decision problem is undecidable. So these kind of laws of quantum logic, so every such thing is in particular of the form that I had shown earlier, right, where you make a bunch of assumptions, in this case encoded in this quantum representation of the hypergraph. This is just a way to talk about some of these assumptions put together, of this orthogonality and completeness. Does this imply that a specific one of these projectors vanishes? So these are candidate laws of quantum logic, and the problem of deciding which ones are valid and which ones are not is so complex that it's undecidable. Yeah, so this is the main kind of statement, the main result. So if you want, you can zoom out now and yeah.
Can you just repeat what you just said about how we should think of this decision problem as a candidate for a law of quantum logic?
Mm-hmm. Not a decision problem itself, but every instance.
Right.
So if given a hypergraph and this W,
yep.
So for example, this one, you can interpret this as a law of quantum logic, which, like the ones on, which is of the form that, which is of this form, that you're making a bunch of assumptions on a number of projections, which in this case are saying that, well, we have some of these orthogonality relations and then these completeness relations, and you ask, does this imply something here? And this something is in this case that a certain projector vanishes.
Thanks.
Okay, and so now I can say a little bit about the proof, but now this is maybe going to be a little bit technical and use some jargon, which maybe is actually not strictly necessary, but which I find helps with thinking about the problem. So for the proof, I just want to repackage this notion of quantum representation a little bit in terms of C-star algebra theory. And so each hypergraph has kind of a C-star algebra associated to it, which is, well, it looks like this. You have these, you know, formal symbols, PV, one for every V, vertex V. And you just kind of throw in their formal products and then are combinations of those. And you need to impose that they satisfy these relations. And so here we have this orthogonality and completeness relation for each hyper edge E. And so then if you do this, it turns out, or it's kind of by construction, the representations of this C-star algebra correspond precisely to the quantum representations of the original hypergraph. And it's a kind of, yeah. And so then one can phrase the decision problem as asking whether that PW, which is one of these generators, already vanishes in this algebra.
Do you have a norm in the algebra? In the
yes.
What is it?
You can define it in various ways, but maybe the simplest way is just to say that you take, so that this defines a star algebra, and you consider all the representations. And then when you take a polynomial in the generators, you just take the supremum, and you define its norm to be the supremum of all the norms in all representations. Which is maybe a little bit, which is kind of telling you already that this is not really deep, this is just a repackaging. They're equivalent other ways of defining it as well, but I think I don't, in terms of outer bounds and semi-definite programming, but I think I wouldn't want to go into this now. yeah. So, but maybe as a small kind of aside, which I found kind of interesting, was that this undecidability also implies that infinitely many of these C-star algebras are not residually finite dimensional, so this is just some C-star algebra, a theoretic concept, which is about approximating it by finite dimensional things, finite dimensional representations. And so this is saying that these cannot be approximated like that. And I just kind of like that because it's a way of the first time, as far as I know, that this sort of thing has been shown using an undecidability result. Yeah. Okay. And then now getting to the really nitty-gritty of the proof, there's another algebraic structure that plays a role and through which I'm making a connection to Williams' results. And these are the solution groups of Cleef, Liu, and William himself. And I'm actually going to present a little bit of a watered-down version, which is perfectly sufficient or adapted to my purposes. Namely, and I'm also going to, so I think William was presenting it in terms of hypergraphs, but because this might be a little bit confusing, even though I've already introduced the notion of hypergraphs, I'm going to talk about them not like that, but in terms of bipartite graphs. So if you have any bipartite graph, so you have, again, some nodes on one side and a finite set of nodes on the other side, and then you have some edges between these. And so the set of nodes on the left, that's I, and the set of nodes on the right would be T. and then this so-called solution group associated to this bipartite graph is a finitely presented group. So it's again defined in terms of a bunch of elements that are declared to generate it. And these are precisely these xi. So one for each node on the left. And then there are some relations which say which equations you're allowed to use and which equations you can substitute in when you multiply these generators. So these can be used to manipulate these expressions, and that defines the finitely presented group. And so these relations are just that, well, each one of the generators has order 2, meaning it squares to the unit element. The ones that have an edge to some common node on the right are declared to commute. And finally, for every node on the right, the ones that are adjacent to that on the left are supposed to have a product that is the unit. And in this case here, considering this product, I don't need to be concerned with the ordering of the factors, because by this relation, the previous relation, the ordering doesn't matter because all of these commute. Okay, so now at this level, one can formulate a decision problem that is kind of purely group theoretic. Namely, this should have not been a hypergraph, this should have been this bipartite kind of graph thing. Given such a bipartite graph, and a distinguished node on the left, is the generator on this node actually equal to the unit in this group? Does it follow from these relations? Can you combine these relations in order to interpolate sort of between this generator and the unit element, and thereby show that the two are equal by a sequence of manipulations? And so this is one of the problems that William showed to be undecidable. And so this is the one that I'm going to leverage and to prove the other, my main theorem. Okay, and this proceeds via this lemma, which relates that hypergraphs used for algebra that I was presenting earlier, which kind of controls all these quantum representations of the hypergraph, to the C star algebra associated to a solution group. And these are actually turned out to be isomorphic. So given the solution group, or associated to a bipartite graph, I can construct an associated hypergraph such that a solution group C star algebra is isomorphic to the hypergraph C star algebra. And in this way, I can translate this problem, which asks about generators in a solution group coinciding with the unit, into one of the earlier form, into an instance of this problem. Into this type of problem, because the two C star algebras are isomorphic, and the isomorphism between them is also computable. So if I have a generator in a solution group, and I want to ask the question, does it coincide with the unit? I can translate it, I can construct the resulting hypergraph, and ask whether it is the associated projection vanishes in the hypergraph C-star algebra. And now if I had an algorithm, if I had some black box, some kind of procedure for answering that question, then also Williams' decision problem about a solution group, then I would also have a procedure for answering this. And so this is the reduction which makes it work. So I reduce a problem that is known to be undecidable to the one that I actually want to consider. And given that the one that I'm reducing with is known to be undecidable, hence also the one that I'm considering must be undecidable, because otherwise I would have a solution to this one. Okay. Yeah, this is roughly how one can construct the isomorphism, but I think I don't want to get too much into the details of this, but maybe I can say give a little bit of an intuition for it. So these solution groups are basically also intended to model or formalize some kind of contextuality, although that's maybe not how it happened historically, but that's in some sense what they're doing. So
in Herman's paper is first, so.
Oh, okay. Did he introduce the groups already, or?
Well, he's already talking about the relations with variables, so.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. So if you know, for example, that the Merman-Paris magic square, where you have these nine observables, so these you can, this you can phrase in terms of this kind of solution group and this problem, that these generators of the group then correspond to these nine observables. And for each little t, for each of these nodes on the right, each one of these corresponds to one of the column sort of rows, roughly speaking. I'm being a little bit sloppy. Corresponds to each one of these. And that's precisely here why this is imposing that these things commute. Whenever they occur in the same row or column of the magic square, and here they have the parity. Well, okay, to make it really correct, I should also allow for parity plus or minus one here, but that's a bit of a technical detail that one can kind of get around and with a little bit of trickery. And so now, given that these solution groups have something to do with contextuality, where are kind of models of contextuality, and the same applies to these hypergraphs, from this perspective, it's maybe not so surprising that there's a relation between them. So this, all this hypergraph stuff was originally proposed as a formalism for treating contextuality and Cochen-Specker type theorems in a very general manner, in some sense, in the most general manner that we were hoping to be able to think of. And so in particular, the solution group type of contextuality is also captured by the hypergraph type of contextuality. And this is how the reduction works and what this lemma actually does. Okay, so let me finish off by a few final remarks about the Hilbert space dimension and this undecidability, and this undecidability of quantum logic. So this undecidability result in some sense crucially relies on the infinite dimensionality of Hilbert space. That infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces are allowed, the quantum representations of these hypergraphs on infinite dimensional spaces.
By that statement, do you mean that if Hilbert spaces were finite, that quantum logic would be decidable, or just that this proof would be empirical?
It depends a little bit. So if you, for example, choose a fixed range of dimensions, or for example, one particular dimension, or just a finite set of possible dimensions, then it's not so difficult to see that it is decidable, although it's still extremely complex.
Enumeration.
basically by this numerical thing that I was mentioning earlier, which one can make rigorous, meaning not numerical but analytical, using some procedure is called real quantifier elimination.
Right.
So that's an algorithm, basically given any finite list of inequalities and equations with polynomial equations or polynomial inequalities and real variables, there's an algorithm to tell whether it has a solution or not. And this is called real quantifier elimination. And this you can just apply in this case by formulating the problem as a finite set of polynomial inequalities and equations and real variables.
And I guess it doesn't really matter if we're talking about continuous variables or a countably infinite dimension.
No, it doesn't. So yeah. So once you're beyond finite dimension, it doesn't matter. You can actually show that any law of quantum logic at that point ceases to be dependent on the dimension. Okay. Yeah. So this is for finite dimension, but sort of fixed range of dimensions, or single fixed dimension. But what about if we allow arbitrary finite dimensions for the quantum representations? In this case, it turns out that, and maybe I should have said this at the beginning, that the decidability was also already known. And there's an old paper of Lipschitz where this is shown to be undecidable in quite a strong, even without using negation. But there's maybe two reasons for why this is not quite so satisfactory. One being that from the physics perspective, I guess there's not much of a reason to look at a finite but arbitrarily big Hilbert space dimension. I mean, either you say that, well, the universe has, the actual Hilbert space of the universe is infinite dimensional, or you should say that, well, it is finite dimensional, and then kind of maybe try to give some balance on what a dimension is. Yeah, and the other reason is that this, maybe the proof here is maybe not quite so satisfactory. Yeah, I'm quite fascinated by this, that here how this infinite dimensionality really seems to play a crucial role in some sense. I've kind of been looking for this kind of thing for a couple of years and.
What do you mean the proof isn't satisfactory for finite-dimensional?
It somehow makes it, because as far as I understand the paper, it somehow seems to rely on really issues more of arithmetic, having to do with arithmetic and the complex numbers, than with actual geometry or logic or something, let's say. So it somehow proceeds through first showing the undecidability, I think, in terms of number fields or something, and so then it really gets down to arithmetical details in some sense. Roughly, I don't understand it well enough to.
That's not satisfactory.
Well, maybe that was a bit of a strong statement, but yeah, this it's nice to have via your results an argument that to my mind seems kind of cleaner in a way.
In the classical case, is there some analog of dimensionality of a space, and even then, is it decidable in the classical case?
I guess in the classical case it doesn't matter very much, because then propositional logic is already independent of the underlying. So in the classical case, one typically doesn't even talk about state spaces, right? You just talk about truth values. And the reason for that is that in a classical case, everything is kind of determined by the truth values. There's no non-commutativity, so which boils down to that all representations are kind of one-dimensional or split up into one-dimensional things. And in a one-dimensional case, that means the representation just assigns a number to everything, which would be 0, 1, meaning a truth value. I'm not sure if this was, I think there should be a better way to explain it, but right now I'm not. Okay, yeah.
Maybe follow up on that. There could be a kind of classical analog of some of the sort of richness of structure that you have in the quantum case, where you have sort of some non-trivial compatibility relations among a set of properties. So I'm thinking of classical theories where you have an epistemic restriction. So you have some principle that says you can only know so much. Like, for example, you can only know the values of variables that Poisson commute, for instance. So what's interesting about those theories is that they're kind of different from quantum logic in the sense that they, if you ask about, you know, the logic of propositions, it's pretty clear that the conjunction of two propositions should not be their intersection in the Hilbert space. The intersection should be some, you know, deeper classical state that underlies both probability distributions, which isn't itself a valid probability distribution. So in a way, you have a way of understanding the failure of the distributivity property. But in those theories, they're still non-contextual, so they're sort of less radical than the quantum theories. Mm-hmm. So there's possibility, it seems to me, for there's scope for such theories admitting of a non-trivial kind of description of the problem, but where the answer would come back as this is decidable. And only if you have a structure that fails to admit of a non-contextual model,
yep,
will you have undecidability. And there's other clues that there's this connection between decidability and contextuality elsewhere. So the other example of this is Brown and Anders, and also Rausendorf, showed that if you look at a model of computation, which is a measurement-based model, so you have some sort of resource of correlations. It could be a quantum state, or it could be sort of a GPT state. And you have a classical processor that's extremely weak. So it can only do linear gates. And then you ask, all right, well, what, together with these extra resources and the linear gates, what can I compute? Can I compute nonlinear gates, for example? And you can show that only if that resource is contextual can you promote your linear circuit to a nonlinear circuit. But the ability to do nonlinear gates is basically also what you need to have some sort of non-trivial arithmetic and get a Gödel type statement. So there too, it seems like the thing that promotes you, that going from non-contextual to contextual, takes you from decidable to undecidable. I mean, that result was a bit surprising in the sense that people originally thought that contextuality would be sort of about promoting you from universal classical to universal quantum.
How do you get to undecidability? What is undecidable there?
I guess I was just thinking that if my circuit was only linear gates,
yeah,
then it's too trivial to construct
uh-huh.
Gödel type statements. But if I have nonlinear gates, so in terms, you know, in logic speak, if I have, you know,
what do you mean by a Gödel type statement?
What do I mean by that statement?
By a Gödel type statement.
I guess I just mean that. What do I mean? I'm not sure how to say it accurately, but the standard statement that you know better than I do, but how much sophistication do I need in arithmetic to get a proof of Gödel's incompleteness theorem? If I have only, you know, a negation and or in logic,
yeah,
I don't have enough structure, but if I throw and in as well.
Well, for Gödel's theorem, you need the power, you need arithmetic, basically, which means natural numbers, not just logic. You need something to do actual arithmetic with. And then you can show that if you have that, then there is going to be, and if you have some theory which is first order axiomatizable recursively, then there's going to be a statement which is independent of that axiom system. That's roughly what Gödel's theorem says. And then that he constructs an example of such a statement using that kind of diagonalization argument and this Gödel numbering type stuff, which is, I think, what you're referring to.
Yeah. Perhaps it would be more naturally expressed in terms of whether your model of computation has a halting problem or not.
Yes, that's what undecidability is about. Right. Yeah.
So if we talk about these a universal classical computer, it has to have these nonlinear gates to be universal.
Yeah.
So this primitive computer that only has linear gates is certainly not universal. It doesn't have a halting problem. But if I incorporate the nonlinear gates, it does.
Then you got universal computation.
Right. So in a measure-based model computation, the resource of the computational states that can promote me from a linear to nonlinear is exactly contextuality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's yet another instance of the same flavor where it seems to be that contextuality versus non-contextuality might correspond to the difference between decidable and undecidable.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's an interesting perspective.
Well, that then maybe suggests some connection between non-contextuality and infinite dimensions or something.
No, I think it's more about, I mean, in finite dimensions, you still have contextuality, you know? So it's more about that the undecidability comes from infinite dimensional contextuality specifically, at least here. I don't know about that universal, probably not in that universal computation stuff, because those are still finite dimensional systems, I guess.
That's right there.
But here it really comes from the infinite dimensionality, so maybe that's the difference.
Yeah, I think that is a difference.
But it is, does it follow from Lipschitz, his argument that it's undecidable to determine if linear hypergraph algebras has a finite dimensional representation?
Probably not, because his the decision problem that he considers, so his instances are kind of a little bit different. His laws of quantum logic don't even involve negation.
I see.
But they also involve other types of, I had these orthogonality and completeness things.
Uh-huh.
Well, his ones are kind of different.
Gotcha.
And I'm not sure how much they overlap, if at all.
So it's possible that that problem could be undecidable as well, right? Like it doesn't necessarily, like even this proof doesn't necessarily have to be infinite dimensional. Can you prove that?
No, in that case, I think it is decidable if you. So to show that the PW is zero. I'm not 100% sure about this at the moment. I think I'm probably confusing things. But if you look at the other decision problem, the first one that I had mentioned, where you're just asking about the existence of quantum representations.
Yeah, then it's
decidable.
Well,
this one is decidable if you go across over all the finite dimensions.
Is it really? Because
yes, because you can.
How do you certify there isn't one?
To certify that there isn't one, you just that's the. No, wait, maybe I'm confused.
You can certify that there isn't an infinite dimensional one, but you can't certify there isn't a finite.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Sorry. Yes. We had some kind of result about that, but now I don't remember what it was. But there was some. I shouldn't be saying anything.
Because we don't know the first solution groups, that there is a finite dimensional version of the problem.
Yeah.
And it's possible that that's undecidable, but the proof doesn't imply it.
Okay, maybe we can talk about that in a bit more detail, because something I'm just getting confused at the moment.
So just a comment about the framework in which you embed your result. When you summarized quantum logic at the beginning, you focused on these, the Birkhoff von Neumann approach, and the interpretation of the logical connectives in terms of intersection and span.
Yeah.
But there's a different tradition in quantum logic in terms of partial Boolean algebras. So there you say, look, the logical connectives have a limited scope of definition. It's not the case that for any pair of propositions, I can necessarily talk about their conjunction disjunction. But we have an extra binary relation of compatibility.
Yeah.
And then for two things that are compatible, their conjunction and the disjunctions are, again, intersection span, but they're never non-orthogonal anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, it looks like classical logic in all the context in which things are compatible. So it fits much more closely with your contextuality scenario. So I have a feeling that where you're going, it fits better with that tradition of quantum logic, the partial Boolean algebra tradition, rather than the orthomodular lattice tradition.
And so is quantum logic also an established term for that, or?
Yeah, I would say quantum logic is an umbrella term. There are many quantum logics, and so people have proposed different ways in which you could write down.
Sure. And I've just been trying to use the term in which I had a feeling that it was kind of used as an established term for something specific. But maybe I had not quite a right impression from the literature.
Yeah, my impression is it has a broader meaning than this orthomodular lattice.
Yeah. Okay.
And that does raise the question of whether this result of yours has implications for the other quantum logics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, could it be that some other quantum logic might be decidable? Or is that ruled out? Maybe you can come up with a kind of something deserving of the name quantum logic, but which is contrived enough that it's by construction decidable. I mean, I guess that begs the question, what is it?
Partial or piecewise Boolean algebras are probably, I would imagine that is decidable because it looks very classical in some sense and with a few additional restrictions.
Right. And then that raises the question of, does that speak in favor of those quantum logics or against them?
Well, generally, I guess it would speak in favor in the sense that if you want to have something decidable to work with in practice, but maybe it would also say that it would speak against it in the sense that it would not capture all the stuff that you have in quantum theory, actually. Or you would have to, I guess, in order to be sound and complete, so they're complete in the sense that it actually captures all the things that happen in physics, you would also want it to be kind of characterized quantum theory in some sense, right? And that would have to be implemented somehow. And if you do that, then it may as well end up again being undecidable. Because of similar kinds of arguments.
Historically, I just note that, you know, after Birkhoff and von Neumann's work, sort of leading into the 50s and 60s when people were doing quantum logic, when they shifted their attention to partial Boolean algebras, they said, well, you know, at this stage, it's conceivable that we could preserve all the classical laws of logic if we restrict their scope to cases where things are compatible.
Yeah.
And so there's an open question. Could it be that the classical laws of logic hold in those scenarios? And that's how Cauchy and Specker came up with the result. They were asking it from the perspective of quantum logic, and they showed no. Even there, even if you restrict your scope of logical connectives to these contexts where everything's compatible, you still violate the laws of classical logic.
Yeah.
So I also think that probably if you can show undecidability for partial Boolean algebras, it follows that you'll have undecidability for orthomodular lattices just because you're limiting your application of the logical connectives to these compatibilities.
So I think one has to distinguish two things. So one is something like orthomodular lattices, or those partial Boolean algebras, where you just impose some structure like connectives and then a bunch of axioms.
Yeah.
But then those axioms, it's just a finite set. And so these do not capture quantum theory uniquely. So there's other kinds of laws that would hold in quantum theory, but that are not captured by those things.
Uh-huh.
And the other alternative would be you just impose also all the laws that all the things that actually hold in quantum theory, which is presumably something everyone would want to do, right? Because you'd want to really make all the inferences that are valid and not just the ones that some finite or more or less arbitrary list of axioms allow you to do. If you do that, then you will run into this kind of understandability problem. These are, I think, two important distinctions to be made.
Well, let me ask about that distinction, because maybe I'm not quite following you, but my impression is that people often wanted to define quantum logic as, you know, that logic which quantum mechanics defines, like, you know, I define my logical connectives in terms of these geometric concepts from quantum theory. So sort of my logic is supervening on the structure of quantum theory.
Yeah.
And then often they wanted to know, can I come up with some short list of axioms expressed in the language of logic, which implies the full logic, and therefore I could think of this as sort of an axiomatic derivation of quantum theory from the logical perspective. So is this undecidability result, can I think of it as, to some extent, you know, the death of an axiomatic program that shows that, you know, you can't expect to prove all the theorems of...
I can make that a little bit more precise. And anyway, so imagine that you wanted to do that for an infinite dimensional Hilbert space only. And the particular laws that are going to be valid will depend on the dimension, right? So here I've been concerned with laws that hold for all dimensions. But you can, if you just restrict yourself to the laws that hold in infinite dimensions, then there's no recursive system of axioms that would capture this. Recursive in the sense that it could be generated by an algorithm. This is another consequence of this result.
So I'm curious, you mentioned there was this older result that also showed undecidability. Can I interpret that result also as the death of some quantum logic program? And if so, what was the reaction of the quantum logic community? Because I have the impression that they were strongly motivated to have come up with axiomatic schemes for deriving quantum theory. So shouldn't they have been kind of celebrating this result you mentioned and saying this shows that everything we've been trying to do won't work? Or?
I'm not quite sure, to be honest. I had the impression, I mean, I don't really know the literature very well, but from what I've been reading, I had the impression that they didn't actually know about this so much, that it was kind of some kind of obscure mathematical paper that is also kind of difficult to understand. And I had some correspondence with some people actually working on this style of quantum logic in this sense. They were mostly saying, yeah, this kind of, this undecidability is kind of the real thing, whereas the one for finite dimensions is kind of nice, but ultimately not what we want.
So then they're kind of admitting the death of a particular research program.
I haven't asked about that.
You should title the paper "The Death of the Quantum Research."
But I did get a response by one person that was basically along the lines of, I mean, politely formulated and so kind of. But if you read between the lines, it basically says that this, you're all wrong and you misunderstood everything.
You're thinking that's somebody who doesn't want to hear that the research program.
I'm not sure. I mean, as I said, I didn't say that explicitly, and I'm not sure I actually would want to phrase it like that. That's a possible interpretation.
Why is it true that you can't have a recursive program for?
Because if you just look at fixed Hilbert space dimensions, or let's say that in particular infinite dimensional one, you have a complete theory in a sense that every candidate law is either going to be valid or not. And now if you had a complete axiomatization of that, you could just enumerate all consequences of the axioms. And at some point you would either derive the law itself or its negation. And you know that one of the two is going to be valid because you're just looking at one particular dimension.
I forgot you would derive the negation at some point.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, if you don't fix the dimension, then this doesn't apply anymore. So the model theory term is that this is the distinction between complete theories and theories that are not complete. I feel like we've been...
Is completeness exactly the idea that you always derive the I mean, either that something's true or its negation is true.
Yes, yes. So a theory and is basically just a bunch of sentences in your well-formed sentences in your syntax. And the theory is complete as soon as it contains, for every statement, it either contains a statement or its negation.
I have a much more trivial question. The decision problem you first introduced prior to the one that you could show was undecidable,
mm-hmm.
about the existence of a
yes.
quantum realization of a particular
yeah.
hypergraph.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that the answer is not trivially yes just by making everything zero-dimensional? Because here you're not asking, is it the case that for all dimension is there a quantum representation? Or was that implicit?
Very good. okay, so I think in this case we're asking, is there a quantum representation in non-zero dimension?
Okay. non-zero dimension.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, I've been sloppy here.
So this is still open,
yes.
this decision problem
yeah.
is decidable or not, with
mm-hmm.
the caveat of non-zero dimension.
Yes, I think that should be the... Yes, yes. So you're basically asking whether, again, 1 is equal to 0 necessarily. So in this case, in this sense, it's asking about non-zero dimension.
Let's thank the speaker.